So announcements, I won't do this all the way throughout the course, but at least for this first week, just going to give a reminder, homework one is going to be due on Friday. Hopefully everybody is plugging away, hopefully finished with homework one by now. Expect that everybody was done Monday right after class. So good job. Okay, so the plan for today, we finished this kind of introduction, motivating example from the previous couple classes. Today I want to go in and just do some analysis of switching loss, first under hard switching conditions, and then we'll move into analysis of this soft switching operation that we've been talking about. Okay. So in order to do that, I'm going to just look at this general example of a half bridge with inductive load. And I'm going to look at a synchronous implementation in my figures here. I expect that most of you have seen this before, but because it's not something we explicitly cover in the prerequisite courses, I just want to go over a synchronous converter. This sort of switching cell is common to many different converters. If I call this the input and this the output, it's a buck converter. If I call this the input and this the output, it's a boost converter. If I put two of them, it's the full bridge inverter. Attach transformers in, it can be different topologies. This is a, really just treating it as kind of a general switching cell where we have some DC voltage and some inductor current. We'll call IL potentially a function of time. How did I name these? I'm going to call my MOSFET M1 and M2. And if I'm operating this thing synchronously as opposed to, if I looked at this as a boost, this would normally be a diode and a non-synchronous boost. I'm replacing it with a MOSFET. Like we saw in the motivating example, that may give me some benefits in terms of controllability, in terms of reduced conduction losses, but it requires that I take a little bit of care in how I drive these things. So I'm going to look at gate drive signals here. I'm going to call this G1 and this G2, which is just going to be my kind of logic level of what the gate is. I'm not concerned about values or wave shapes, just off on. Okay. But look at these, let's say I switch G2, something like this, off, turn on, turn off. Then G1 is going to be the opposite, assuming this is kind of a CCM type operation. But what I need to do when I'm explicitly switching both devices versus a FET diode implementation is I now have the ability to potentially turn both of these on at the same time. Doing so would be absolutely disastrous for my converter because I have this DC bus, I'm assuming is a fixed DC voltage. If I turn both of these FETs on, the extent to which they're ideal, I get some spike of infinite current. I'm going to short out that DC bus. I need to ensure that never happens, and I'll do that by implementing a deadband where I'm going to shut off one device and delay some time before I turn the next device on. This will be my G1, and now I have this band on both switching actions, which I'll call TD. The dead time. Okay, and I do this for a number of reasons. There'll be limitations on the minimum dead time related to how I'm providing these signals related to the gate signals themselves and related to the actual operation of the converter. So as far as implementation, maybe I find that none of the other factors matter and I could make this dead band as small as 1 picosecond, but I always have something conducting. But it's probably going to cost me more to build a controller that has 1 picosecond resolution on its timing of these different signals. I may have limitations just there in my kind of whatever timer counter is providing these signals, what its resolution is. I can have issues with my gate signals. Here I'm drawing G1 and G2 as just square waves. In a real implementation, I would likely have, as we've briefly discussed and we'll get into more, at my edges, I might have a real VGS one that looks something like this. A real VGS 2 looks something like this. Because there is parasitic charge, parasitic resistances, these things aren't just vertical edges. They take some time to rise and fall. And kind of this is the point, switch colors. This is the point where I'd begin my turn on of M2. This is the point where I begin my turn off of M1. And you see there's some overlap here. If my threshold voltage is up here, I might be okay. There's a little bit of overlap, but it happens below threshold, so both devices are really off during that time. If my threshold is somewhere down here, I'm in trouble, and I'm going to have this what we call shoot-through event, where both devices are partially or fully on, and I get a spike of current going through this DC bus. Okay. The other limitation, if I look at my switch node, the switch, what's the value of that going to be? Well, when G1's on, it's going to be VDC. When G2's on, it's going to be zero. And what's it going to do in this dead band? Who knows, right? I'm going to have both sets off. So what happens during that deadband depends on what the circuit surrounding this thing is doing. So if I have, for example, a very large IL in the direction I've drawn, when I turn both these sets off, that current has to flow somewhere. And what I still have is my parasitic body diodes. Devices. So if IO is greater than zero, I've got a current in this direction that cannot go through this diode. It's going to go up and go through the high side diode, right? So during both of these dead bands, it's going to forward bias that high side diode and keep the switch node high for that entire dead band. If IL less than zero, the opposite can happen. Now my current's flowing this way. It cannot go through that diode. Instead, it's going to have to come up through this diode. IL less than zero, as soon as I shut off, this current's going to drop and spend the whole dead band going through the low side. If IL is some small value and I consider parasitic capacitances and resistances in here, these edges could kind of be anywhere in between. It's not going to sit at a different DC level, but I could have resonant transitions. I could have things that look more or less linear. Could have, draw some examples. I could have things that ramp up real quick and have a little bit of bi diode, things that go right to the resonant transition, things that don't quite make it, and then get shorted on. I could have kind of a variety of things in here depending on what's going on during this dead time. But we'll be limited kind of in this range. And this is now a period where switch node voltage is not controlled by my gate signal, controlled by kind of parasitic capacitances and inductor currents, initial conditions, and a passive circuit. So what I'd like to do now is begin talking about the process of switching a FET and looking at some of the losses that show up during that. We'll start by looking at the gate charge, which we mentioned briefly a couple lectures ago. But for any real physical MOSFET, we have some non-zero amount of charge required to transition its gate to source voltage. I call this my power MOSFET. In order to quickly bring the VGS high and drop it back low when we want to shut off, what we want is a circuit driving that gate, which has kind of high current capability that can quickly supply charge, quickly remove charge from it. And that's this gate driver circuit that we use in power electronics to kind of increase the current capability from whatever is generating these signals. So it might be using a microcontroller or a DSP, their IO are kind of limited in the maybe tens, hundreds of milliamps range. And if we have, I don't know, 10 nanocoulombs and we're only having 10 milliamps of current to supply that, we would need now a microsecond to do so. If we have an amp, we only need 10 nanoseconds. So we put in what is functionally a buffer. That is going to take our input drive signal coming from, this is my PWM, coming from my controller. And provide kind of a low impedance output, have a high current drive capability, potentially do some level shifting as well. I'm sending in a 3.3 volt signal and I might want 15 volts to drive the gate to source of this MOSFET. As I mentioned the other day, the way that's done most commonly is really a small half bridge of its own. And we may connect this as a simple inverter. I want that to work, and I want this to be an inversion, so I might have a second inverter in here so it still behaves like a buffer, invert twice so I get the same signal out that's in. But these FETs are fairly large and able to provide higher current than what I could get just out of the controller itself. Being said, they are not ideal, not infinite, and they will have their own resistance, on resistance. We'll call R on of the high side, R on of the low side. And either intentionally or just what happens to be in the MOSFET, I'll have some external resistance here, RG. So I may supplement this by adding resistance if I, for one reason or another, feel the need to slow this transition down. This may just be internally the resistance of the actual gate metallization or gate polysilicon of the power MOSFET itself. So, like I said, if let's say I want to turn this thing on at 10 volts, in order to turn it on, what I'm going to do is I'm going to send this signal high. That is going to turn on the high side MOSFET, and I'll be providing current in this path from my go away. Sorry about that. From whatever DC voltage my driver is. In this case, I'd want V drive equal to 10 volts, trying to drive 10 volts. So I'm going to short that MOSFET on through this resistance, my turn on resistance called the RGI is my RG plus my R on of the high side FET. Through that total resistance, I'm going to supply the amount of charge necessary to get me up to 10 volts. It's my V drive. And that looks like about 17 nanocoulombs. So I'm going to have an energy associated with that, which is 17 nanocoulombs. Charge is an integral of current. That's all provided from a DC bus voltage. I multiply 17 nanocoulombs times 10 volts. That's my integral of V times I. And that'll give me the total energy taken from the DC supply V drive in order to turn this thing on. So I'm going to have an energy look like V drive times whatever that charge was. When I shut this thing off, I'll turn off that high side buffer MOSFET, turn on the low side, and I'm going to, as we've looked at before, kind of short out gate to source. That charge that I supplied, all of this energy, some of it was lost in the resistance, but I supplied some amount of charge to the gate. When I short this thing back out, all that residual charge left in the gate is dissipated on these two resistances, shorted out and lost. So this is going to realize there's a power loss. This is that PG that we looked at before. This is V drive times QG times FS. If I switch this once off, once on per switching period, we'll lose this energy every switching cycle. Okay. Questions so far? Well, pretty easy.
Why don't you consider the loss in RG and
beyond? I do. In fact, so if I, for example, considered only the energy that went to the gate, right? That would look like a 1/2 CV squared. If I modeled the capacitance of that gate, it's nonlinear looking at this curve, which we'll get into in a moment. Like say Q is equal to CV and I get kind of a 1/2 QV. Here, I lost that half, right? Where is the other half? The half that's lost on the resistance. Just made your homework problem a lot easier. Forget I said that, but then relearn it by Friday. Okay. So this charging process is fundamentally, in this configuration, it looks kind of like an RC type charging, and it's going to have characteristics of an RC type rise. For what follows, I'm going to simplify my analysis a little bit by instead assuming that my gate driver looks like a constant current, and I'll motivate why that's a valid assumption in a moment. But what I'm going to do is say, assume that this buffer instead really looks like during turn on, just some fixed current source that it pumps into the gate. During turn off, switches over and is fixed current source pulling charge out of the gate. Call that IG V drive. Where this makes things a little bit simpler is current is charge per second. So now I can look at this plot of the gate charge and think of this bottom axis just as a time. And the time is going to be basically this is charge per second. I divide the two, I get time back. So my IG is some charge per second. So if, for example, I set IG is equal to 1, then I can come down here and I can just relabel this axis as time in nanoseconds. If I set IG is equal to 10, I'd have to divide all these numbers by 10, then it'd be time in nanoseconds. This allows me to look at what the gate-to-source waveform would actually look like as I slowly turn this thing on. And you notice these significant nonlinearities, right? So it looks like maybe a normal capacitance over this range, where I've got some constant slope, some constant current charging a fixed capacitance up to this point, then I'm completely flat. Looks like somehow I'm just dumping all that current somewhere, and then back to a constant capacitance type behavior. If you look closely, this slope up here is a little bit steeper than the one down low. So it's changed value a little bit. We'll look at that more in a moment. I want to first, real quickly, and I didn't get this in the notes that I posted online, but this is just more of an FYI aside, look at where these charges are going. So if I look at the cross section of a power MOSFET, it looks something like this. Got drain down low, gate and source up high. I've got many unit cells of a power MOSFET, kind of this section here in parallel on this die. I put a lot of them on there to build up the current handling capability of it. And I've got big heavy metallization on the source. Everything here is metal, and then the entire bottom of it is the drain. That's all metal. So if I look at this power MOSFET in the off state, what's going to happen is perhaps short gate and source. When it was on, there was an inversion layer here in the channel, shorting gate and source. I'm going to get rid of that, dissipate that, and then I'm going to apply a positive drain to source voltage. When I do so, what I get is something that looks like this. At this PN junction, I'm going to form a depletion region. That field is blocked across the depletion region by the stored charges there. That depletion region is going to expand with VDS, and that's a region completely devoid of precarriers, right? Depletion region by definition. Now, when I want to start looking at the parasitic charges of this device, I look at capacitances between any of the different nodes, gate source, drain source, gate drain. So when I look gate source, there's a lot just in the structure. This is all a gate pad. This is all source metal. I have a lot of this CGS comma M. I'm just saying the component of gate to source capacitance due to this metallization. I have a lot of just capacitance because I've got conductors next to each other all throughout this device. I have gate-to-source capacitance from the gate down to the N-wells on any side, from the gate down to the P-wells, which are shorted together in a power MOSFET. The body diode is shorted to source. The body contact is shorted to the source. So I have a whole lot of capacitance gate-to-source just due to all this stuff being real close together. Gate-to-drain, on the other hand, got my gate up here, my drain down here. My metallization is conductive to this region because it has free carriers left, but this entire depletion region looks like some big dielectric. So my only component of gate to drain capacitance is really trying to go across this depletion region. I'm going to have, in general, in this MOSFET, a CGS, which is sizable and fairly linear, because it really just has to do with these different materials being close to one another. And then I'm going to have a CGD, which is much smaller. And very nonlinear due to it depending on this depletion region, which changes in size with the reverse bias voltage. Something we'll look at more later. So CGS is a much bigger capacitance. It's going to take a lot more charge to transition in an equal voltage, which will be important when we start looking at why this QG is the shape that it is. So in the next couple of slides, I'm going to go kind of back and forth between this slide looking at the gate charge and this slide where we're really going to look at the turn-on transition of the low side MOSFET, which I've been calling M2. With my DC bus, I'm going to look at switch node voltage, the drain to source current of M2, and the drain to source voltage, excuse me, I'm calling that switch node voltage. I'm going to look at the gate to source voltage. Switch node voltage is the drain to source of device M2. I'm going to plot those here. VGS, IDS, V-switch. We're going to look at what happens as I turn this thing on and off at essentially a constant current, like motivating the previous slide. So I'm going to look at the start before I turn M2 on. Assume that prior to starting, VGS was low, IDS was zero, and V-switch was up here at some value, VDC. Okay. And at this point, at the start of my vertical axis, I'm going to begin trying to turn on M2. And I'm going to do so by supplying this constant current into the gate of the device. Like I was saying before, in time, now we're going to kind of begin tracing out this same curve, providing 1 amp, to be 1 nanocoulomb per nanosecond. And we'll begin ramping up VGS voltage with this constant slope at low voltage. As I begin ramping this thing up, really nothing's going to happen, right? Until I hit the threshold voltage of this device, providing this charge, raising the gate source voltage does nothing. It's still fully and cut off, at least to the extent that I'm approximating this as ideal, it's not going to really do anything. So as I ramp up, eventually I'm going to hit some threshold voltage. For this example device, I took from the table on the data sheet that that's about 3 volts. So until I reach this position, I don't do much of anything. Once I hit this, however, my device is going to begin turning on. At this time, call this the threshold. My drain to source current is still zero. Drain to source voltage is still the full DC bus. So once I hit threshold, what operating mode is this going to go into? should go into saturation. So it has a very high voltage across it, and it's going to have a relatively low VGS. So down here in this plot in the bottom right, I'm looking at the transfer characteristics, VDS versus ID for some example device. And as I'm plotting these waveforms, I want to go through and look at where it's operating on these characteristics. So when I started, I was in cutoff. I had some large VDS voltage, and I had zero gate voltage, put me down here, no drain current on kind of the cutoff characteristic. As I begin ramping up my gate to source voltage, I'm really initially just sticking right here, because anything below threshold is all cutoff. It's all this ID is equal to zero line. But eventually, once I hit that threshold, I'm going to turn on and I'm going to come out of cutoff. During this region here. And the first thing that's going to happen is what? Once I come out of cutoff, I'm going to start jumping around on the characteristics of this device. I'm really confined to this curve. You said I'm going to be in saturation initially. So once I hit threshold, my behavior of the device is going to be defined by the saturation characteristic, which for power devices, we simplify to GFS times VGS minus VTH is equal to the drain current. GFS is this transconductance of the device, parameter of the power MOSFET itself. I'm going to go into the saturation operation where it really looks like a voltage controlled current source, right? My gate to source voltage is controlling my amount of drain current through this GFS parameter. Once I get above the threshold, that begins to be greater than zero ID, and my device is going to begin taking over current. So what's going to happen, initially, I'm going to assume the inductor current was this direction, and that would have been flowing up through M1's body diode. I'm assuming there was this dead time that we just talked about before I try to turn on the low side. The current is commutated over to that diode. Diode is going to lock the drain to source voltage until I can take all that current away from it. So after I hit the threshold, my gate to source voltage is going to continue ramping up. But as it does, this device is going to be taking over more current. More of that IL is going to transition away from the body diode and down through the MOSFET. So this IDS is going to be ramping up proportionally to VGS, and it's going to go until a point where it reaches all of the inductor current, IL. The gate to source voltage, move this up a little bit, is going to reach a point, I'm going to call it VM. VM is the point at which that GFS times VGS minus VTH is equal to the inductor current, the point where it's taken over all of whatever current is being fed into the circuit. So say VM is the solution to IL is equal to GFS times VM minus VTH. Okay. On my characteristic down here, what does that look like? Well, my VDS, because the diode is still on, because I haven't taken over all the inductor current, the remainder has to flow up through that high side diode. My VDS is going to remain unchanged. Going to continue here. On my transfer characteristic, what I'm doing is I'm ramping up through these gate to source voltage curves until I reach a point where I've taken over all of the inductor current. Numbers are somewhat arbitrary right here, but I'll call this IL. Okay. Motivated before, things aren't looking good so far. This is kind of the region I want to stay away from in this transfer characteristic, where I've got simultaneous voltage and current. From this point, I've taken over all the inductor current. The diode now can shut off. I will, for simplicity of analysis, assume this is some perfect ideal Schottky diode. There's no reverse recovery. Once the current's gone, it's just off. At that point, what's going to happen is I can begin dropping this VDS voltage. Now it's no longer clamped by the diode, so I can start transitioning down. That's going to, on my transfer characteristic, be moving in this direction, where the device maintains all the inductor current but drops the drain to source voltage. In doing so, looking at my gate charge plot, this was my VTH, this is my VM, and this is where I go into this first significant nonlinearity, where the gate to source voltage really remains flat while providing some charge from the gate driver. You know, what we talked about with capacitances, if I have charge going into CGS, it's going to increase the voltage, Q is equal to CV. So if I'm supplying charge to the gate, this voltage isn't increasing. Where is that charge going? Got to be going up through CGD. Right. This is the Miller Plateau, hopefully everybody's familiar with. And what it is CGD is much smaller than CGS. So if I want to transition them both by 1 volt, I'll need much less charge going into CGD. But here, I'm potentially switching a much larger voltage across CGD when I begin to change the drain to source. The gate to source is going to see 0 to 10, 0 to 15. This is a 600 volt device. This is going to see 600 minus 0 to 15. I can put a much larger voltage on this, and even though it's a much smaller capacitance, a larger voltage means I still need a significant amount of charge to go up into it. Okay. Confused looks?
It's going to see 600 minus 0 to 15.
Right.
The delta V across is like 585. Or is it?
Delta sense? V is going to go up to 600 if I have drain at 600 and the device is off. And then, depending on the exact dynamics, how high I get in the gate before that starts coming down, I'm just leaving myself some wiggle room. But
it's around 600. That's the order.
Yeah. 600 minus some smaller thing to the gate source voltage. And it's going to go down as low as minus 15, right? So when I turn the device on, it'll drop to zero, but the gate will still be high. So I'm going to really have about a 600 volt swing on a 600 volt blocking device. So now once I've taken over the inductor current, now the gate is really driving up through the gate to drain to provide the charge necessary to bring that VDS voltage down. So that's going to basically lock in my gate to source voltage for some amount of time on this Miller Plateau, because little or none of the charge provided by the gate driver is actually going into CGS. It's all going up into CGD. At the same time, I am bringing down the gate to source voltage because of all of that charge flowing up through it, going in the opposite direction. And it's going from gate to drain, whereas my voltage is drain to gate. That current is bringing its voltage down. And it's only once I bring that all the way down to roughly zero that I've actually finished my switching transition. And this whole time, I'm going to have a constant IL flowing through the device. It's taking over that current, and there's no other path. Not that the diode is off. Here, I finally got my MOSFET fully on down in the ohmic or triode region, and then I can finish the transition. Now I'm just charging CGS again to get up to my eventual value V drive. By this point, the FET is on in ohmic, and that extra increase in VGS voltage is just bringing the on resistance down that little bit extra. Okay. On my transfer characteristic here, what is that? So this third interval, the Miller plateau, is bringing the voltage down at constant current. I eventually get somewhere down here where I transition over from saturation active into the ohmic triode region. This is my interval 3. And then my interval 4 here is really just that last little bit to decrease the on resistance. Okay. So, not good. I did what I said I don't want to do. I spent a bunch of time out here with simultaneous voltage and current, as we talked about before. That will result in power loss. The power loss is going to be the product of V and I. With these waveforms, it's relatively simple to evaluate that. So I want to look at the product of V and I. It's going to look like zero here where the drain current is zero. Then the drain current will ramp up with constant drain to source voltage. It'll reach its peak value. Then the constant drain to source current will ramp down the drain to source voltage. And here, drain to source voltage is zero. This is my product IDS times VDS. This looks like a triangle. The peak value is going to be simultaneously peak current and peak voltage. It's going to be VDS times IL. VDC times IL. And the time here, I'm going to call T overlap. That has to do with this mechanism that we're examining here, this loss that we're looking at. Going to be called overlap type power loss due to during switching when there's an overlap of voltage and current. Okay. That time, if I assume it's known, I can solve for the total energy here. This be my energy due to overlap loss. It looks like the area of this triangle, 1/2 base times height. And I'll have an overlap power loss, which looks like lap times FS. Okay. If I go ahead and go one step further and plug that in, this is 1/2 VDC IL times T overlap times FS. FS is 1/TS. So it looks like a ratio of the amount of switching time I'm spending in this overlap state to the total switching period, which makes sense. So what is this overlap time? Now we can solve it from back here under the assumption of our constant gate current. He said if the gate current is 1 amp, this is my time, and my overlap is really occurring from when I hit the threshold to when I get out of the Miller plateau. So if this is my device and I've got 1 amp, looks like about 5, 6, maybe 7.5 nanoseconds would be my overlap time. Now, I made this assumption that I could consider this to be a constant current drive on the gate driver, and it's clearly not, right? It's some kind of R and nonlinear C that's charging this, right? So instead of being a constant current, my gate will really always be, if I've got my high side device on and I'm charging, it will be V drive minus VGS over the sum of these two resistances. Right. V drive is something like 15 volts. And the part of this curve that I really care about is this overlap time. So I've got 15 minus 3 at the start of it and 15 minus 5 for the duration of it over some resistance. Let's call it 1 ohm. So I'm going to go from 12 amps to 10 amps. During that time. And even though the full characteristic, the current is not going to remain at all constant, it's going to be kind of an RC rise. During the time that's really dictating all of my switching loss, the gate to source voltage doesn't change much, and the current is close to constant during that time. We should get something similar to these waveforms, even if I don't apply this approximation of just the constant gate current. As long as I select the value for that constant gate current to be close to what it would actually be. Okay. Questions on that? All make sense? Everybody's done this before. Everybody knows it well. Perfect. Going through, just to formalize what we said here, our operating modes went from cut off to active FET to ohmic triode during the course of this transition. The device transconductance that I mentioned, GFS, can be gotten from these same waveforms. And here I just showed the example of how I pulled that from these waveforms at a given VDS somewhere over here in the saturation range. I'm just taking VGS is 4.5, VGS is 5, VGS is 5.5 and 6, taking the current at all of those and plotting those 4 points. That's this blue line. And it's very close to a approximated linear GFS. Okay. Now, taking that, I went in and did a simulation of this same switching transition, made up the numbers for all the parameters just so we could look at this in a simulation. The other thing I did is I took the model for my MOSFET. Go back. And I took out any CGD, CGS, CDS, took out all of its parasitic capacitances and instead added my own just so that I could look at currents through these, not have them be internal to the MOSFET model itself. But here I'm switching this thing as something like a boost converter. Rather than wait for the simulation to get into steady state, I just put a fixed current source, fixed output voltage, and then simulated one switching action, one turn on. So I start the gate at zero, I supply a constant 1 amp to it, let the simulation run until it gets fully on. Yeah. Looking at those waveforms, gate voltage looks as expected. It's got this kind of stair step wave shape. If I look down here, I've got the current into CGD and the current into CGS. You see, as we argued, in this first section, we're charging CGS up until we reach that Miller voltage where the entire current has been taken over. During this Miller time, all of the current is going into CGD to bring that voltage down. And then during this last section, we're back to charging CGS. If I look at the current waveforms, the drain current of the device, and the switch node voltage, expected we take over current first. Once we've taken over that full amp, we can begin dropping the voltage at a rate controlled by this current flowing into CGD. Questions? Okay. We'll pick up there on Friday. See you then. Thank you.